A few weeks ago, I came across a video. It was a National Geographic video about geese. And this was somewhere, I want to say it was Greenland, I believe. And these geese, some kind of Siberian types of, or Arctic geese, they would lay their eggs, they would build a nest high up on a cliff to keep it away, keep the nest and the eggs away from predators and so forth. It was pretty cold. And the video goes to show, it's up on this high cliff, it's like a 400-foot drop-off from this precipice. And then down at the bottom of the cliff and about a mile out, there's a lake and there's some grass by this lake that it says that once the eggs have hatched, these goslings, they've got about 36 hours before they starve to death. And the geese cannot bring food up to the nest. They just weren't able to, or they don't, or something. So they have to get these three goslings down this cliff and off to... So how are they going to get... And by the way, they can't fly. The hatchlings can't fly for another month. So they have a 400-foot... how are they going to do this? And so first the dad takes off and goes down, and then the mom takes off. And then, one at a time, these little hatchlings, they just, you know, they don't have any feathers yet, they can't fly. They just eventually muster the courage to jump off this cliff. And they look like they're in a wingsuit, if you've ever seen one of those things, where they're just falling. And they can't fly, a couple of them are like, you know, flapping their featherless wings a little bit, but basically just a free fall, 400 feet down until they clam, smash into the rocks at the bottom and kind of roll around, and the first one hits and lands and boom, and rolls around and comes to this stop and just lying there. And then a couple seconds later, it flips over and, okay, he survived it, but he is stunned, but he's not out of the woods yet, because here comes this blackbird that swoops down, and the mother goose sees the danger and swoops down and is in between, but it's on this steep, the rocky footing is not so good, and so the bird jukes and the goose, you know, kind of loses footing. The bird goes right around, grabs the hatchling and takes off, and that's the end of number one. So number one didn't make it. Then here comes number two. Same thing, just free fall, splat. He goes over a different side where the fall is not quite as long, but there's more jaggedy rocks, and so he hits them. He's banging against this wall and that wall, and boom, 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 and then he just disappears, and he doesn't survive the fall. So we're down to one out of three. And the third one jumps up. Sure enough, splat, and bang, bang, flipping around, finally comes, lands on this steep ice, doesn't have much footing. Here comes the mother, and she doesn't have much footing either, so they're sliding down and finally makes it to the bottom, and number three makes it. So one out of three, and then they go off, and the dad and the mom lead it, this 1 mile hike to the river and to the grass, and one out of three makes it. And when I was watching that, afterwards I was thinking, that's kind of like what it's like to be a brand new Christian sometimes. It's like, you just hatched out of your egg, so to speak. You're born again. But it's not easy going to be a Christian. And sometimes it's like, first thing out, you got a 400-foot drop, and there's difficulties of life, and there's persecutions and things like that. And if you survive the fall, then there's predators coming after you. The devil walks about seeking whom he may devour. And welcome to Christianity. You know, it's like, who wants to be a Christian now? And being a Christian, there are some places in the world and some times that it's been more like this than others. Any time in history, there are places in the world where there's bad persecution. But probably the highest, most difficult persecution, where people know what it's like to believe in Jesus. They know what they're getting into. They know it's been difficult. Probably the hardest time will be during the tribulation period under the rulership of the man that's introduced to us in Revelation 13, known as the Antichrist. I've entitled our message tonight, and we're not going to get to all of it tonight, but We'll look at about the first half of Revelation 13. I've entitled our message for tonight and next week, The Unholy Trinity. And we'll talk more about, in fact, we won't even, when I titled the message that, I was planning to get to that. We're not even going to get to just talking about that, so we'll save that for next week. But I want to look at the first part of that tonight with the Antichrist as he is introduced to us. By the way, we've seen him earlier in the book of Revelation, briefly, but he is more specifically formally introduced and who he is, what he's like, what he does. So let's jump in Revelation 13 and verse 1. And it says this, And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So several things here to kind of unpack as we go through. Here's the introduction here. This beast rises up out of the sea, from the sand of the sea. Or John standing on the sand sea and he sees this. A beast rises up out of the sea with 7 heads and 10 horns. So this beast is the Antichrist. That's how he is often referred to in the book of Revelation as the beast. So what does it mean that he has 7 heads and 10 horns? Hold your finger here and look at a similar passage. I'm just going to read it. We won't make much comment on it tonight because we'll get there eventually. But Revelation 17, look a few chapters to the right. Revelation 17, and I want to start reading in verse 7. And we see the same imagery here of the 7 heads and 10 horns, only it gives us some explanation about what that means, what it points to. So Revelation 17, verse 7, it says, And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? So he sees this beast and the woman riding on the beast, and he admires. And the angel says, Why did you marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. So this beast with the 7 heads and 10 horns is the same as in Revelation 13, verse 8. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are 7 kings, 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th, and is of the 7, and goeth into perdition. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have 1 mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. So the beast here, by the way, is sometimes interchangeably, and you see this often in history, the beast is interchangeably a man, the Antichrist, and the kingdom that the Antichrist rules over. And sometimes you'll see that in history when you'll say that Nebuchadnezzar, for instance, came against Israel. Well, it wasn't just Nebuchadnezzar. It was his kingdom. It was the Babylonian kingdom. And sometimes Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon were used interchangeably. And so that's what happens here with the Antichrist. The beast is at the same time the Antichrist, the person, but he is also the kingdom, this which is often referred to as the revitalized or the resurrected Roman Empire from the Old Testament and from ancient history, that he is now reigning over. And so it says that the what I wanted to focus on by looking at Revelation 17 was that he had seven heads and ten horns. And it explains that the seven are both seven mountains, and we'll get into more of that when we get to Revelation 17, and then also seven kings that go in sequence. The first five have already passed, and people often will say that those, I don't want to mention too much on that for sake of time tonight, but they're past kings in ancient history. And then we get to the sixth and the seventh, where the one is yet to come, and so forth. So suffice it to say for this evening that these seven heads are seven kings as well. And then the ten horns, in verse 12 it says that the ten horns are ten kings which haven't received kingdom as yet. So people often say that, and what is a popular interpretation of this, is that these ten horns is that there's going to be a federation of ten nations that are ruling alongside of or under the Antichrist. People, right when the European Union several years ago was founded, it started off with ten, and people thought, that's it, we're going into the end times, and then numbers changed, and people would come in and out of the European Union through Brexit and so forth. So anyway, we're not trying to determine who is certain things, but there will be at some point a ten pronged kingdom with ten kings here, and they will, it says, for 1 hour with the beast they will receive power. They'll come to power, they'll be this worldwide, this is a one world government, and they're not over the entire world as far as this one kingdom. There's going to be war between them and others, and we may look at that at some point. So that's, let's go back to Revelation 13. So there's the introduction there of the beast, Antichrist, who rises up out of the sea. And by the way, the concept of the sea, for sake of time tonight, we won't kind of demonstrate this, but the sea often in the Bible, not every time, but the sea often in the Bible represents the nations, multitudes of nations in the world. And so the Antichrist here rises up from those nations, often the Gentiles as opposed to the Jews, and then the earth as opposed to the sea is sometimes mentioned as the Jewish nation. So we'll talk about that later. But so the beast, the Antichrist, rises up out of the sea. He's like a leopard. His feet are like the feet of a bear. His mouth is the mouth of a lion. And by the way, in the book of Daniel, we may look at that tonight in a little bit. But you see this imagery that's similar in the book of Daniel to the same person, the Antichrist. It mentions a leopard and so forth. And then it says, and the dragon gave him his power. We know who the dragon is. That's the devil. The devil, Satan, is the power behind the Antichrist. It says he gives him his power and his seat or his throne and great authority. So I want to look at, before we go on in Revelation 13, I want to look at other places in the Bible where the Antichrist is mentioned. So the thought I want to show is that the Antichrist is prophesied. Obviously, we're reading in Revelation, we read it like it's history, but it's a prophecy of things to come. But the Antichrist is in multiple places prophesied by God in the Bible. So let's look at some places in the book of Daniel. Look at Daniel chapter 7. I was trying to decide how much of this to read tonight. Daniel 7 talks about the Antichrist. Daniel 8 talks about the Antichrist. Daniel 9 talks about the Antichrist, just briefly. So he's a popular man in the book of Daniel. Not popular in a good way, but maybe we could use the word infamous. But let's read this section, Daniel chapter 7, verses 19 down through 28. For sake of, I know we're jumping in the middle here of the context. There are four beasts. And for sake of time, we're not going to talk about the three beasts before him. But the fourth beast here is the Antichrist, and we'll just focus on him tonight. So Daniel 7, verse 19 says this. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse or different from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, there's that same imagery of the 10 horns in Daniel and Revelation. And of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things. And that's something that you'll see often with the Antichrist, is that he's speaking great things and is talking about blasphemous things. He's speaking things that he is great, even lifted up above God. So that's what it means when he says he spake great things. Whose look, middle end of verse 20, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. We'll see that in Revelation 13. Until the Ancient of Days came. That's Jesus. So he is fighting against the believers. He's winning until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws. And they shall be given into his hand until, and we'll see this time frame, we've seen it already in the book of Revelation, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. In the book of Revelation, it calls it a time, times, and half a time, which is a year and 2 years and half a year. So 3.5 years, which is the 3.5, the second half of the 7-year tribulation. So that's that. The Antichrist, by the way, is going to be there for the entire period, but he's going to be, I believe, empowered at the midpoint, and he's going to have all this power and authority and do great things for the second half during the Great Tribulation. Look at verse 26. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me. I was thinking about this, and my thoughts were troubling me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. So reference here to the Antichrist, and some of the things mentioned that he does here are repeated and mentioned that he does in Revelation 13. But I just wanted to show that when God reveals it to John, it wasn't the first time. He's already revealed this person to Daniel. Again, Daniel 8 talks more about the Antichrist. For a second time, let's just skip over. Look at Daniel chapter 9, and we'll just look at the two last verses where it mentions him there. Daniel 9, verse 26. So this is talking about the 70 weeks and the 70th week of Daniel. So Daniel 9:26, and after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. That's talking about the crucifixion, dying for our sins. And the people of the prince that shall come. So this is the Antichrist here is called the prince that shall come. The people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he, by the way, this is perhaps, I believe, the only time in the Bible where we see that the Antichrist is there for the full 7 years. When you read about him, we just read in Daniel 7, when you read about Revelation 13, it sounds like he just comes about. He wasn't there, and now all of a sudden he's there for the 3.5 years, but he's there for the full 7 years because of what it says here. It says in verse 27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, which is 1 7, which means 7 years. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So he's going to rise to power, but he's going to be a nice guy. It's going to be a little bit of a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde scenario, where he's going to be Dr. Jekyll. He's going to be everything is great. He's a world leader. He unites the world willingly. They all come. He makes a treaty, basically kind of a peace treaty with the whole world. He brings world peace finally. And then his true stripes are revealed at the midpoint of tribulation. Or maybe we can even say this, because of what we're going to see, of what we see in Revelation 13. I believe that at the midpoint, so by the way, in I was going to say back in Revelation 13, but we'll be back there in just a minute. What did we just see in the previous chapter, in chapter 12? We saw Satan cast down from heaven at the midpoint of the tribulation. And it says for that second 3.5 years, he is going to go after God's people. He's going to go after Israel and persecute them. And I believe he does that through the Antichrist. And so I believe that about the same moment that he is cast down is when John sees the Antichrist rise out of the sea, receiving his power from the devil. So the Antichrist is there, but at the midpoint of the tribulation, I believe the devil, and I believe this, and I hear other people say this, and I agree with it, I believe that the devil probably inhabits, that he possesses the Antichrist, that he enters into him like he did with Judas Iscariot, and like he did with others during the days. Well, some usually it's demons, but I believe the devil himself entered into Judas Iscariot, and I think he does that with the Antichrist, and he empowers him. He's doing miracles. He's doing amazing things. I believe the first half of the tribulation, the Antichrist is just another guy with good ideas, and then all of a sudden the devil gives him power supernaturally at the midpoint of the tribulation, and then he goes and does Mr. Hyde types of things, you know, horrible things. So look at, before we go back to Revelation 13, a couple more places where the Antichrist is talked about. Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. We'll look at a few verses there. 2 Thessalonians 2. And he goes by different names in different places. He's not always called the Antichrist, but by the things that he does, we will see the same activity, so we know that it's him. So 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, it says this. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, the day of the Lord, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed. So here he's called the man of sin, he's also called the son of perdition, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And that's often referred to as the abomination of desolation, where he goes into the temple. Skip down to verse 8. It says, and then shall that wicked, or that wicked one, be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And so, similar things, that everyone, there, it's either one or the other. He is a polarizing figure. He'll be the most polarizing figure in all of human history. You will literally either worship him or not and worship God. Those will be the two options. We often talk about the mark of the beast, and that's, you know, we'll see this. That will be an act of worship. They'll be declaring, I believe that the Antichrist is God. That's what he's going to declare. He's going to say, I'm God. You need to take my mark in your hand or in your forehead to buy or sell or do anything. If you don't, you'll be beheaded, you will be killed. But if you do, you'll be killed. So it says that everyone that takes the mark will, at the same moment, either the strong delusion comes into them and they take the mark, or they take the mark and the strong delusion precludes them from ever receiving the gospel. But anyone who ever takes the mark, that was clear, will not believe the gospel, will not end up in heaven. Every person that takes the mark of the beast will be, as it uses it in 2 Thessalonians 2, that they will all be damned that believe not the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And so God sends them strong delusion. God, they harden their hearts. This is similar to Pharaoh. They will harden their hearts, and then God will harden their hearts. And they will end up believing a lie, taking the mark of the beast, and ultimately ending up in hell. It's a horrible thing, and this is because of the Antichrist. One more place. Look at 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18. So this verse calls him the Antichrist, but it also references other and many Antichrists. And the Bible talks about a spirit of Antichrist that's already in the world. So 1 John 2, verse 18, it says, little children, it is the last time. So we've been in the last days, or the last time, ever since Jesus ascended back up to heaven. The church age, the entire church age, is often called the last time. We have no idea when it will be over, but it's already the last days. And as ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time. So remember, we've mentioned this before, the word Antichrist, the Greek for anti is anti. It's anti in the Greek. And that prefix means both. It means either or, sometimes both. It means against. We often hear antibacterial, you know, something that goes against something. But it also means instead of. The Greek prefix anti also means instead of, not just against. But by the way, they work together. The Antichrist will say, I am Christ. I am instead of Christ. And by doing that, he will be against Christ. Because nobody can say, I am God and be for God. You know, that blasphemy, you're putting yourself in God's place. You have to try to push him off his throne in order to sit on the throne. So the Antichrist will be both against and instead of God. But notice, he's not just going to say, I hate God. He's going to say, I am God. He's going to say, God is good, and you should worship God, and I am him, and I am Christ, and so forth. So he's going to be a false Christ. So first of all, the Antichrist is prophesied by God in Scripture. And by the way, whenever God says all these things in advance, when God tells us the Antichrist is coming, it points to two things. One, it's God's foreknowledge. Yes, he knows that it's going to happen. But it also points to this. It points that he is not just his foreknowledge, but his agency. That God is allowing the Antichrist to do what he does. And if I can use the word, and we'll see this here in just a moment. And go back to Revelation chapter 13 as we go on. That the Antichrist is not only prophesied by God, but he is allowed by God to do what he does. You think, well, if anybody would ever try something like that, God would never allow that to happen. But he does allow it to happen. He allows it to happen for 3.5 years. Everything that ever happens in all of human history, God either directly does it, he is the doer of it, or he indirectly allows it. And if God ever wanted anything to not happen, he could stop it in a second. So whenever something is allowed to happen, we ought to always take a step back and say, well, why did God allow this to happen? We need to come to the right conclusion, by the way. I robbed a bank, and I didn't really rob a bank. I'm not speaking hypothetically. If I were to rob a bank and get away with it, I could say, hey, God allowed this to happen. It must mean God is for this. God wants me to rob another bank. You know, we need to have the right conclusions. God, sometimes He's giving me a test to see if I will choose right. Sometimes God is working something else. But don't come to the conclusion just because God allows something that He is for it and that He loves it and He's pro that. Nevertheless, God allows, you know, every sin that's ever been committed. God has allowed it to happen. God has allowed us to have a free will. He hasn't always intervened and headed us off at the paths to make sure that our free will can never be expressed and we can never do wrong, because that would be horrible. God allows our free will, and He will allow the Antichrist, even to the point where we could say that God is giving him. It said this about Nebuchadnezzar, by the way. Nebuchadnezzar was a horrible man. He was an unbeliever. I think at the end he became a believer, based on Daniel chapter 4. But God set him up. God gave Nebuchadnezzar's power so that he could fight against Israel, because Israel was being wicked. And so God judged him with the battle of the captivity. It doesn't mean that he was for Nebuchadnezzar, but he raised him up so that he could bring judgment. So look at back in Revelation 13 as we go on. Go ahead and let's look at verses 3 and 4, and then we'll get to two verses, verses 5 and 7 specifically, that shows God's agency in bringing the Antichrist to power. So Revelation 13, verse 3. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves too much. It says, "And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast, and who is able to make war with him?" So all the world will, it says, they will wonder. The phrase in verse 13, one of his heads, as it were. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. Some people debate about, what does this mean? Did the Antichrist die and come back to life? Was he resurrected? Potentially here, there is a false resurrection or a faked resurrection or something like that, because it doesn't say that he was wounded to death. It says he was, as it were, wounded to death. That it seemed, maybe he personally had a certain injury, a wound or something, and they thought that he died. Maybe he was pronounced dead, but he really wasn't. But the devil's involved here. We're not sure how much power God gives the devil here, because there are miracles that are done for sure. But I wouldn't say that he died and comes back to life, but it says he was as it were. And all the world thinks that he came back to life, potentially. That's what's happening. And they all wonder after him. We got to follow this guy because he came back from the dead. And look who he is and look what he's doing. And they all worship, notice at the same time, they worship Satan and they worship the Antichrist simultaneously. And they say, there's nobody like the beast. Who's able to make war with him? He's the most unstoppable force in the world, and we all just need to submit and get behind him. That's what the entire world does. And here's what it says. Look at verse 5. "And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations." So notice there are four times it uses that phrase, that something was given unto him. And who is doing the giving? I think we can maybe say a combination. The devil's there giving his power, but ultimately God has signed off on it. Just like Job. The devil wanted to go after Job, and God allowed him. If God said, no, you can't touch Job, then nothing would have happened. But he allowed him to do that. So God is giving to the Antichrist power and authority and a time frame. By the way, this, when you see the in the end of verse 5, where it says power was given unto him to continue 42 months, that's not the devil. The devil can't decide how long. God is the one setting that time frame. All right, it's going to be 42 months, and then you are done. And then Jesus is going to come back and fight against him and kill him and defeat him and so forth. So God is allowing the Antichrist to have this power. And he's going to do miracles. And we'll see more of that next week with the false prophet and so forth. But by the way, in what verse was it? The lying wonders. That was in 2nd... drawing a blank on that. When the Bible says that the Antichrist will do signs and wonders and lying wonders, it doesn't mean that it's not really a miracle, it's a lying miracle, it's a deception, it's like sleight of hand. I believe that it's really a miracle, but the lie is what it points to. He does a miracle and says, I'm God. So that's a lying wonder. A real wonder is a miracle that says the Bible is true and God is God. So this lie, I do believe that the Antichrist is going to be given supernatural power through the devil and allowed by God. And it's going to be worldwide fawning over the Antichrist, worldwide admiration, worldwide worship. He's the greatest thing we've ever seen. He's even greater than Obama. You know, some people think, you know, if you remember when Obama first was elected, people, like, older people were like teeny boppers. They were fainting in his presence and things like this. And I just popped them out. That wasn't in my notes. I wasn't planning on talking about Obama. But he's going to be like a rock star type of figure. Worldwide leader. He's got all the answers. He even came back from the dead, they believe. And so all this will happen for 42 months. He will be empowered by and doing the bidding of the devil. Someone has mentioned this. I thought it was an interesting thought. Look at Matthew chapter 4. Basically, what seems to happen with the Antichrist is what the devil offered Jesus when he tempted him in the wilderness. He comes and makes the same offer to the Antichrist, and the Antichrist takes it. You could say that he sells his soul to the devil type of thing. So look what the devil offered Jesus, which the devil had the... Jesus, when the devil says this, Jesus does not say, hey, what are you talking about? I'm the king of the world. You don't have the ability. Jesus doesn't say that. He doesn't refute the devil. And by the way, if the devil didn't have this power, he definitely wouldn't have come to Jesus and offered to do this if he didn't have it. So he has this right now because of the fall. So look at Matthew 4, verse 8. Again, the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me. And so the devil says to Jesus, I'll give you, which basically is what Jesus is reclaiming in the book of Revelation without the help of the devil. Jesus didn't need the devil to give this to him. He just needed to lay down his life for the sins of the world and then come and reclaim everything during the tribulation period, right at the end of the tribulation period. So he didn't need it from the devil, but he didn't have it at that moment. The devil has this, and I believe the devil comes to the Antichrist and offers him this, and he says, I'll take it. And then the devil comes in and empowers, and I believe even possesses the Antichrist, and goes on and says these things, like, I am God, and bow down and worship me. So let's go on and read down through, back in Revelation 13, read down through verse 10, and then we'll close up for this evening. So, verse 7. He's going to make war with the saints, overcome them. Verse 8, and all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So, it's going to be a successful deception. He goes into the temple, says, I'm God, and the entire world, every single man, woman, boy, and girl that has the cognitive ability to worship will worship the Antichrist, except for believers, except for those that believe in Jesus and have their names written in the book of life. Everyone else, this is a one world religion, basically. There's not Muslims over here and Hindu and, Sikh and all these types of things. It's just going to be one person, the Antichrist. Everyone on the planet will worship him that doesn't have his name written in the book of life. And then look at verse 9. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. What's verse 10 saying there? Who's it talking about and what's the purpose? I think it's talking about the Antichrist and all of his forces. Because by the way, to kill so many people that are killed, the Antichrist doesn't do it single-handedly. He's got his fingers and his network and his all these other kings and people doing his bidding. And they will kill many people. It seems that beheading is the choice way that people are killed. But whoever leads into captivity will go into captivity. Whoever kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. And so the Antichrist and his regime will ultimately come to this same fate, is what it's saying. They will reap what they've sown. Whoso rolleth a stone, it shall return upon him. That's the idea. Remember what Jesus said to Peter in the garden that night. Put away your sword, because all they that take the sword will die by the sword. And so he's saying that that is going to apply to the Antichrist. He's going to have 3.5 years of success, of worldwide domination and being worshipped and killing the saints, killing believers. But at the end of it, he will come to his end. We're not going to get to that tonight, obviously. But it's just it says, this is the patience and faith of the saints. They will go through that persecution. And the one thing that helps them to hold on is knowing this, that the story's not over. And Jesus is going to come back and set everything right. And the Antichrist that we will not bow to, he will one day fail. So I had this, I was going to ask myself this question. Why would God allow? So God allows the Antichrist and all this to happen. So this is Psalm 73 on steroids. When Asaph sees the prosperity of the wicked and the righteous suffering, this will be the zenith of that type of phenomena. That evil will be flourishing. The Antichrist will be thriving. No one will stand before him. And he will chase down, and I don't know the percentage of believers. I tend to lean toward this, that there are unbelieving Jews that will make it through the tribulation, and then they will believe at the end of the tribulation. But those that believe in Jesus during the tribulation period, I think maybe even a majority of them are killed. I don't know the percentage. It doesn't give us a percentage. But I had this thought. Would you rather be in the kingdom? Because the way that when someone enters the kingdom, and we're not going to hash out this tonight, but when someone enters the kingdom, they will live in that kingdom for 1,000 years without dying. Would you rather, but those that have died will come back and reign with Jesus, but they'll be in their glorified bodies. Would you rather spend the kingdom in your glorified body or in your physical body you have now? Hopefully that's a no-brainer for you. But the way to enter the kingdom with a glorified body is you have to die before you get to the kingdom. So there will be many believers, and maybe most, I'm not going to say all, I have no idea the percentage, but God is going to allow his believers to be slaughtered, broad stroke. Many, many, many believers will be slaughtered by the Antichrist. And you say, why would God allow this? And so at the same time, you have evil flourishing, you have righteousness being put down and being destroyed, it seems like. And all the people in the world are watching this, and then they make their decision. Should I worship the Antichrist, or should I worship Jesus? Okay? If I worship Jesus, get my head chopped off. If I worship the Antichrist, everything is good. All right? I worship the Antichrist. And so the end result, experientially, of God allowing evil to flourish during this time and righteousness to be killed, is that most people will go the way of the Antichrist. And you say, why does Jesus allow this? Why wouldn't he allow righteousness to be blessed and prosper so that people see that? Oh, now I want to worship Jesus. Why does he allow righteousness to kind of fall on its face and be killed for those 3.5 years? Why wouldn't God set the circumstances that are more favorable to truth? And I think the answer is that a lot of tribulation is a big test for people to see, are you going to follow and worship what you can see, what seems like it's winning now? Or are you going to believe truth that's written in the Word of God? Are you going to believe the promises of the Word of God, even though you can't see them borne out right now? Or are you going to go with what you can see? And God is going to allow this litmus test for people. And then once they say, no, I think I'd rather chase after what I can see, God's going to give them strong delusion, and they'll never believe the truth. And so I wanted to finish with that thought. How about us today? Not just in salvation, but as believers. Are we leaning toward what seems successful right now? And, you know, we live in a cancel culture society, and truth is maligned. So, I mean, I don't want to raise my hand in public and say I believe the truth because I might be canceled. And are we drifting toward what society, what everyone says is good, or with what the Bible? Or are we willing to say, let God be true and every man a liar, if need be? What if nobody believed the truth but you? Would you still believe it? Would you still stand? And there are times, we don't have it going on right now, where in America, that if you say, I believe in Jesus, you get your head chopped off. That's not the case right now. What if it were the case? What would you gravitate toward? What would you stand for? In so many of the world, it's just broad is the way that leads to destruction, because narrow is the way that leads to life, and few there be that find it. So may we stand in our lives, when you're at work, when you're even in, sometimes it's family members that are unbelievers, and they're looking to see what we're going to do. May we stand for truth when it's unpopular. People say, well, if I were there and they say, I'll chop my head off, then I would stand for truth. Would we? Are we willing to stand for truth when they won't chop our head off? Are we willing to stand with God even when it's just people might think weird things about us? We need to let God be true and every man a liar. Next week we're going to get into the false prophet after the Antichrist. So let's close together in a word of prayer.